Hi, I'm Fran Brill, and you're listening to a podcast where nostalgia comes alive. It's Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. Roll it.
Welcome to Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, the podcast where nostalgia comes alive. Since July of 2021, Jake and his friends have interviewed professionals in the worlds of acting, directing, writing, puppeteering, and many more. Who will they be chatting with in this week's interview? Find out in this Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show episode.
Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show, where nostalgia comes alive. Happy here with us, thank you for joining. As always, I'm your host, Jake Duffenbaugh. With me today, of course, our co-host, Chris Bixby and Matt Bingle. How are you guys doing?
Doing good. Hi everybody, how are you, Jake?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thank you for asking.
Excellent. Who do we have today?
Today's guest we have for today, he's a playwright and a writer. A lot of you may know his writing work for writing lots of series that we will touch base on later, including Beavis and Butthead, Out of the Box, Giant Sprites, and the Marpets. But notably, he's also a writer and a creator of a PBS series, Peg Plus Cat, and many others that we'll touch base on later on. Please welcome Mr. Billy Arison. Happy to have you here, Billy. Welcome.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Yay, doing great.
Yay. Awesome.
Wonderful.
Happy to be here. Yes, definitely pressure. So to kick things off, we know who you are, but for those who haven't, could you tell our audience a bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. Well, I guess playwright is sort of what I call myself, is sort of the center of everything. But I started writing for TV for money at first, and then I kind of found that I was terrible at a lot of television writing, writing for kids or writing odd animated stuff, writing anything twisted came naturally. So that has become a passion of mine as well. And I've also written for the musical theater. Rent is the one everybody's heard of that I'm one of the creators of. And like you said, you summarized the children's TV, some educational stuff like Peg Plus Cat. I had the pleasure of creating a PBS cartoon with Jennifer Oxley. But I'd written for Beavis and Butthead and Courage the Cowardly Dog.
Yes.
And, which has its fans. And other educational, the Wonder Pets, other educational stuff. And even an opera for kids that was just done in Sweden. So all kinds of stuff, anything that's odd, funny.
Nice. Very nice. So what was your childhood like and how did you grow up?
Somehow I grew up. How? I guess I was upset. I fantasized a lot. I was really into music. I daydreamed a lot. People thought I was weird even then. And then in the 60s, like, people thought I was a girl because I had hair that went over my ears and over my forehead. And I played the flute instead of football. But I was always making up stories in my head. It wasn't until college that I decided I had to be a playwright. Sort of, I had my first romance. It broke my heart and ripped me up in ways I couldn't know I could be ripped up. Suffering I couldn't have imagined, along with the incredible joy. And so I had to do something with that. I also performed. I liked acting, as scary as it was, and performing in what we call jazz groups or rock groups like the Beatles or the Monkees or whoever was at that time.
Yes.
So.
Nice.
Kind of summarizes the early years.
What inspired you to want to get into writing as a career?
Well, I would say before it was a career, it was a way of life. And that sort of began in college, I guess. The first year in college, I took courses like organic chemistry. I thought I might want to be a doctor or something where you get paid for helping people every day. It's a nice idea. But I was so obsessed with this, trying to make up stories and about things that were unusual that I had to express so badly. If you're an artist or if you're in the arts, you know what it is. You just have to do this thing, whether it's music or painting. You just can't get it out any other way. Mm. So I became obsessed with theater. It was rarely got course credit for it, but I just had to write a play and trick my friends or force them or cajole them, wheel and deal them to being in my plays. And that was going to be my way of getting through college. Then I really thought, what can I do to make money afterwards? But I applied for a teaching job. It's just, I ended up going to drama school. All I wanted to do was write. I even tried, I wanted to be like my dad was a doctor. So I really wanted to do something where I help people every day and make money. I just couldn't get, that seemed like such a cool way to live your life. So I took a year off to do social work. And I loved the idea of helping people. I just wasn't good at social work. You know, I couldn't, the 9-to-5 thing and the putting on a tie and being articulate and nice in front of people, it was hard. So I got right back to the writing, and it sort of, then I just found I had to make a life out of it. So I had to make money with skills that were related. I just found I could, I tried writing, I tried being a paralegal late at night. A lot of people who are new in New York were doing these kinds of jobs to make money. And it was okay. I mean, you can do anything you want to make money as far as I'm concerned, that leaves you time to do your art. But I just found that if I could use my skills, my writing skills, to make money, that was quicker. Mm-hmm. And eventually it became as exciting and cool as my playwriting, I thought. So it sort of backed into it as a career. And I was forced to make it a career because I had no choice, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
Awesome. So I'm kind of curious. Do you remember your very first writing job?
For money? I mean, getting paid for money, that job, kind of job?
Yeah, professional. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess it was when Nickelodeon was brand new in the 80s. They had this show called Turkey TV. They might have paid us $75 for a sketch. They would just do anything silly. And now it's, you know, very divided. Young kids, older kids. Then it was just juvenile, all ages, disgusting green slime everywhere, whether it was for young kids or all teenagers. It was just all too juvenile for adult television, and it was cheap. So I just wrote a lot for that. And then it pretended to be like a David Letterman type show with funny sketches called Don't Just Sit There. And I wrote a lot for that just because it was fun. It came quick, just goofy ideas with having fun with language or a lot of physical comedy. That stuff, I learned a lot by writing a lot. You know, I had to write a lot because I figured if I could write 4 of these things in a day, that's a good day's, that would be enough money to justify it. I could take a night off from the law firm. So you say, okay, there, it's a 5-minute sketch. I'm going to sit down. I have 8 hours. In the first hour, I'm going to think of the sketch. Next hour, I'm going to write it up. Next hour, I'll think of another sketch. Next hour, write it up. Lunch break. And then you do the same thing and you turn them in. And, it was just, I did enjoy that it afforded me a chance to write a lot. Try an idea, jam with it, have fun with the language, find a structure, do it. Whereas playwriting, it can be precious. You know, you write a whole play and you spend a long time on it, you give it to a theater, they take a long time to read it, give it to all the theaters you know, beg them to work on it. Somebody eventually might have a reading, you know, they sit around and read the script to the artistic director. So it just is so slow and it has to be perfect. You have to feel that it's perfect. Or why waste all these people's time? Right. But for Turkey TV and things like that, like bam, bam, it was a blast.
Very nice. So early on in your career, you were a head writer on the Comedy Central series Short Attention Span Theater.
Yes.
What was working on that like?
Well, Mark Maron, who's now kind of famous, maybe you know him. He's a comedian, very dark sense of humor, brilliant, I think. He was the host. It was a show. Comedy Central had a lot of these shows when they were brand new, where they just showed clips from other shows, from like Monty Python or Woody Allen movies, and any comedy stuff. Kids in the Hall used to show a lot. So they just needed somebody. It wasn't a glamorous job, although I like saying I work at Comedy Central, but it was just setting up the clip. So here's another, you know, a fun way to say, here's Monty Python. We're doing shows of clips about cheese today. Here's Monty Python and their cheese sketch. Think of a fun way to say it, and that would be right for Mark Maron, the comedian host, to say it. I kind of found there that although my stuff is generally, when people like it, they say that's funny, they laugh a lot, they go ha, that just sort of happened. And it surprised me at first when I was writing the plays, because I thought I'm pouring out my heart here and you're going ha. So I learned that you can make money with that. But I found at Comedy Central, when the pressure is to be funny, I didn't like being funny so much. I think it's like, for example, if somebody says, I'm going to tell you a joke, I feel too much pressure already. It's very hard for me to laugh. So I guess I learned at Comedy Central that trying to do comedy, to write stand-up comedy or jokes that's mainly just funny, wasn't really for me. My funny comes from something else, something being personal, have a personality, or teaching something a certain way. It's funny. But anyway, so I learned a lot from that job.
Nice, nice. So as Jake mentioned in your introduction, you also wrote several episodes of the MTV series Beavis and Butthead. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, that was a blast. That was the first time that I was invited to write a show that I was already watching.
My wife, really?
When Beavis first came out, it was just so different than everything. It just, they stop, those kid characters, just they just sit there and laugh at a dirty joke for 10 minutes. Well, it feels like,
yeah.
You know.
Such a funny show.
Even my wife liked it. She won't admit it, but we just sit there. That's so nuts. And it's true. It's actually brilliant writing. That's how it felt to me.
Oh, yeah.
When I was those ages. Yeah. You know, all you think about is girls or breasts, whatever it is. And at least in my case, I was nowhere near breasts. I mean, I didn't have a chance. I was a hideous physical specimen, you know? So I loved that show. And when I was invited to write for Mike Judge and Chris Brown, I guess, was the head writer who worked with him, I was just thrilled. And again, that didn't pay very much at that time. It might have been 100 or 200 a sketch. I forget, but we were all so honored to be writing for it that they could have paid us anything. And I pitched them one idea after another after another. They've invited me to make four of them. Two of them turned out well, I think. And then I kept going and writing more. They bought more scripts, right, that they wanted. But I think there was a change because mine were so much about breasts. And eventually Mike said, you know what, it's enough about breasts, so we won't use these four that Aronson wrote. But every minute of work, there was one, I got to go in person in one meeting where we all would sit around and brainstorm ideas. And it was great. These guys, I could see every one of them would have been like Beavis and Butthead 10 years ago. You know, we think of a funny, disgusting idea and everybody crack up. And there were a couple women in the room too. But we all just had that same sense of humor. Like we're a little too big or too small or too weird or too something, you know, and yet we found a way to make a life writing.
That's nice. Yeah, again, very funny show.
Mike is a genius, yeah. I think. He's just so talented, Mike Judge.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So most of your writing jobs have been on various children's series, including the Carmen Sandiego game shows. We're talking Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego and Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego. What was it like working on those?
Again, I thought those were really good shows. Especially the first one, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. For that one, I guess this guy named McPaul Smith was the head writer, really funny guy. And I got to write, there was a section where somebody described, gosh, I don't even remember it now. They go into a certain part of the world and to find some villain, and I had to use clever language to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was such a cool show, and I got to see the audience sometimes. There was a live audience. They were fun. We danced around Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego and get my friends with their kids to come in to be in the audience. It was just tons of fun to be associated with that show. The second one about history, they did a good job, but I could never figure out it was like the conceit is someone's gone back in time to steal something from history, to steal some object. And so in search for them, we'd go all through history where things that were related to that object. But the thing is, if that object was stolen, none of those other things that we were certain that we were finding would have been there anymore.
Right.
You know, so I was just, I had trouble getting my mind around it, but it was still fun to write for.
Yeah.
Nice people.
Yeah,
those are lots of fun.
When you combine like educational stuff and kids, you tend to get nice people. They're not really pushed. They're not to get rich.
Right.
Or show off their egos. They're there to have a good time, and I always like the people I met there.
Yeah, absolutely. I was quickly going to say we also previously interviewed Greg Lee, who was the host.
Yes.
And Sean Altman from Rockapella. We also had him on too.
Oh, they were great
guys.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yes.
Oh, they really are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wonderful guys. So you also wrote various Sesame Street projects, starting with the co-production Sesame English.
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, that was different. That was as I recall, it was set. We used a couple of Muppets and some Sesame Street material to teach English to a teenager, middle school kids around the world. So again, it was one of those projects where they used me a lot, and that was so much fun. It was one sketch after another, writing for Tingo and this girl. Kelly Carbash was the actress's name, who went on to be in Rent. And the guy who played Tingo, John, went on to have a. This is where my age and forgetting names is a problem. But he went the back. What's the Disney show that he went on to do? With puppets. Anyway, it'll come back. Anyway, they're both very talented people, and it was a blast.
Oh, it was John Tartaglia.
Yes.
Johnny and the Sprites, yeah.
Yes.
He got his start. So everybody.
One of our favorite people in the world.
Yes.
He is so cool.
Yeah.
And everybody who was on that was talented again. He's a really funny guy and a lovely guy. So he was fun to write for. It was pretty quick. You know, you write a sketch, the actors do what they can with it, and then they shoot it. PBS Sesame Workshop never had a lot of had extra money. Like they, I would imagine in Hollywood, if they're going to get something right, they spend a long time on the close-up. This was not like that. They rehearsed it a couple times and shot it, but usually it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, and some of the things you got to write for Sesame Street include the home video Bert and Ernie's Wordplay. Can you talk about writing that?
Bert and Ernie's Wordplay. Yeah, that was a while ago, but it was fun. I love those characters, right?
Yeah.
And Elmo and again Bert and Ernie. Bert and Ernie. I also did some claymation stuff with Bert and Ernie.
Yes, yeah.
And they're just brilliant. It's an honor to be to
yeah,
get
yeah, the right Bernie's like Great Adventures, yeah.
Yes.
Love that segment.
Yeah. Bert and Ernie's Greatest. That was claymation. And I think an Italian company did the claymation on that. But I loved it. I love a lot about the Sesame Street aesthetic because it's so much like writing for the Three Stooges or any classic comedy. They did great bits with puppets that were educational somehow. Bert and Ernie are great characters. I love their conflict. It works on so many levels. And they're like a pair of brothers, but it's also some of the greatest physical comedy you'll ever see. So writing for them on those claymation bits was pretty fun. And also the home video, as I recall, that was, they did a lot of Sesame Street home videos. That one they brought me in because I think they wanted more comedy than they usually had. So I tried very hard to be as funny as possible, and I hope that they enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a fun one. And I know you also co-wrote that with one of our previous guests and good friends, Annie Evans.
Yes.
Annie, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Love Annie.
The thing about Sesame Street, it's so successful and has been for so long. There's a sense of, they're aware of that. When they work on Sesame Street, they're aware that they want something a certain way and that they know how to do it. So I was brought in, you know, they said my producer, Jill Gluckson, wanted somebody different, more maybe slapstick, wacky humor, whatever it was. And there was resistance. But with Andy at my side, they accepted. We got it through. So I was glad to have her as a partner on that.
Yeah, because she was a writer on Sesame Street for a long time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it changed. Yeah. When I was young, when it began, you could do anything on that show. You could rip off somebody's nose. You know,
oh yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's gotten more and more as we've gotten more sensitive about what young people should see, what 3 to 5 year olds should see.
Yeah.
I could go on record as saying I disagree with this whole trend. I think it's better to show something that works for everybody, that people get things that a young person doesn't get all of it. Because when I was a kid, I would see Bugs Bunny cartoons, and those things are still stay with me. There's something profound about them, about the way Yosemite Sam doesn't know what to do with that anger. And he's got a gun, and yet he's the most impotent character in the whole thing. There's something profound about that. And you don't get it all when you're 3 or 5 or when I first saw them. You don't even get it all when you're in middle school, but it's just profound and thrilling. And so so I miss that, you know, I like the old way, but now they do it.
Yeah.
It's very careful to be exactly for that age. Some things that they can digest instantly that are good for them, right? That they can quote, the tester can say, what did you just learn after watching that? You know? 2 plus 2 is 4. Oh, you learned something,
Yeah,
because, with the, unfortunately, we can't, the shows can't do, have, any, some, like a humor, like it does back then, to now. It's just not,
so much has changed,
Yeah, back then you could kind of go more off the rails.
But now, it's now.
Not so much now.
There's a very kind of, curricular goal that you really have to follow with Sesame Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very specific. And I like the shows where a teenager or the babysitter might want to stay and watch with the kid.
Oh yeah.
Or the parent might want to watch with the kid, like The Simpsons. But if not, now they tend to be so specific for this age only. This is for 3 to 4, you know, so that if you're not that age, even the big brother doesn't want to watch it. It's just, yeah, that's boring. That's, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just for that kid so that they can watch without supervision, with minimal supervision, which is a reality of how, I guess, kids are experiencing TV nowadays.
Yeah.
Exactly. So now, moving on from Sesame Street, you wrote several episodes for the Cartoon Network series Courage the Cowardly Dog.
Yeah.
What was it like into writing for that?
Well, at first, that one, I didn't know the show when John Dilworth brought me in. But, and I thought, okay, it's real, a scary kid, a scary cartoon for kids, you know, and how are we going to do this? But as I worked on it, I just fell in love with it. I think he's the other genius that I worked with in kids TV. John Dilworth is this, let me just say, if you met him, you wouldn't be surprised that the cartoons are the way they are. He's got this unique way of seeing the world that's just skewed in a wonderful way. And he's scared. I mean, he sees a lot of what's scary in the world, like Courage the Dog does. So it's not, there's nothing flippant about it. It's really, he's on to something that means a lot to him and that he would fight for to get it. And then that's why there are other shows that might have made more money quickly, but his lasts because there's something really thoughtful about it and original. So I did love writing for that one. And the writing for it was scary because you go in, I'm used to, you know, thinking for myself in my privacy of my own home, here's what the story should be. I'm used to that. We would go in and there'd be a room with John there, and his sister was also very smart about story. And he had a couple of other experts who'd done lots of, been doing cartoons for a while, and the head writer and another writer or two. We'd be sitting there and John would toss out an idea, or I'd come in with an idea that I thought out before, and then they would move it to here and then move it to here. And John would have ideas for visuals that he wanted to get in there somehow. So that would get in there. And then, but now how do I tie it up into his ending? You know, there's so many ideas, and I'd get home with all my notes. I'd say, how's it supposed to end? Or how do we get from this to this? But that was sort of the fun of it, as scary as it was. It always worked out. And that was a show where they didn't change much. Like when I wrote something, because John had liked it when we were creating it, it usually stayed, we didn't have to change too much. And then I had the pleasure of seeing them. They always look better. They look great, I thought, when they were finally animated.
Yes, that's another wonderful show. And you also got to write, over the years, several projects for Disney, including, I guess, one of their earliest children's shows, Out of the Box. Of course, which starred Tony and Vivian. What was it like working with them?
I didn't work with them personally so much. The writers were separate on that one. That was one of those shows when Disney was just starting to do for very young kids. And it was interesting. We had, what were the hosts' name again? Vivian and?
Tony.
Tony was upset when I wanted to do a show about Abraham Lincoln. There was always a theme. And so I did one about what about the theme of great leaders, what great leaders are, what Lincoln was, and how to make a Lincoln hat and that sort of thing. And when he got the script, when he came in to shoot it, he said, I don't want to do this because it says that Lincoln was a great man. And we were beginning to look at history more critically, American history critically, the way we do now. And Lincoln had said some things that upset him that seemed to be condoning racism. We could argue for a long time about whether Lincoln said those things to keep the country together or not, whether it was his true belief or not. But at any rate, Tony didn't want to say them, and that was fine. So I had to rewrite that one. Just not saying that Lincoln was a great man. It was still about leaders and about Lincoln. But so that was interesting. I learned a lot from that. But yeah, Disney's done a lot. They've gotten big in children's television.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, love that show.
Absolutely. Yes. Very good show. Another Disney series you wrote for, we briefly brought up earlier, Johnny and the Sprite, starring the amazingly talented John Tartaglia, also a previous guest of ours.
Yes.
What was working on that and working with him like?
Well, he's just a lovely guy. I mean, he would be in on the story meetings.
Oh, yeah.
He was so supportive, and he knew he could tell us things he thought would work. And it was fun taking his suggestions, but he never felt like he was ordering us to do anything. And we all worshipped him. We all wanted to please him and
oh,
show
yeah.
him. Talents.
Absolutely.
So all the puppets. It was a very, very creative show, I thought.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've seen, but he's also in charge of the new Fraggle Rock reboot that's out there. And he does a great job with that.
Yeah, it is amazing. It really is.
He's done such an amazing job for that. So, I don't
think storylines, techniques.
I don't think there'll be a better person to get in a charge for those, you know, positions more than Johnny, honestly.
Nobody else.
Yeah, very talented.
I saw him in Avenue Q. That was a Broadway show he was in.
Yes, love Avenue Q.
Yes,
love
that one too.
Three Tempted Away.
Oh yes,
yeah. Sure. And him being like a creative supervisor, like a producer,
for the
writer,
franchise
director,
now.
Writer, director, he's done so much.
Yeah, so proud of him.
Absolutely. So you also wrote for the Noggin series, the Upside Down show, starring the Umbilical Brothers. What was that like?
That was fun. They're nuts. Those guys are so wacky. Anything can happen in that show. It was a blast. I mean, we had to make it a little bit educational, like all children's television. So there might have been some words we featured, or some, I think, vocabulary was what we finally made the educational content. And even that was fun because we got to use big words in new ways. And it's just a joy. It's a privilege to get to do these kind of assignments because it opens up your head. You realize there's new ways to tell a story, new kinds. I mean, I never would have created characters like them. I mean, they barely were characters. They were like weirdness. You know, I couldn't tell you what their personalities were, except that they were just hilarious and twisted, and they could do anything. And it had finding a way to make a story out of that and to find a rhythm. And what's the language? How do they speak? It was great. It was a real one. I think, I went to drama school, but I think you learn more from writing things that people are going to see than from writing for hypothetical situations, like sitting around with your teacher and reading it. So that was drama school for me, was writing for all these different funny people and twisted people, things that someone needed to see. Mm. And getting paid for it was nice instead of borrowing money.
Yeah, love that show too. So now you wrote a number of episodes for another Nick Jr. series, The Wonder Pets, as well as serving as a head writer for most of the show's run. What was it like working on that?
Working on The Wonder Pets, that was my first job. I mean, it was a real job. I worked in an office because everybody in those days, I don't think anybody does this anymore, but we worked in person in the studio, all the animators and Josh Selig and Jennifer Oxley, the creators of the show. And the storyboard people were down the hall. And the producers were all there. And then the kids came in to record downstairs once in a while. And I was the head writer. That was my first job with that kind of responsibility. The trick of being head writer is that, you know, I'm used to, as a freelancer, you write and then they change it if they want. But I was there in the studio. I was responsible for changing things so that the creator, the owner of the company, the president, Josh Selig, would be happy. So I had to try to write in his handwriting a little bit. I mean, he encouraged creativity and imagination, and he wanted me to do it my way, but I kind of had to be sensitive to what his way was going to be with my way. It's hard. It's an odd collaboration. You know, that was new to me, was having someone right there who you've got to please. Made great friends there. I'm still like, it just was a great group of people, and the joy of being in person was my favorite thing about the Wonder Pets. Also, I like those characters, Lenny and Tuck and Mimi.
Yeah.
It's a funny show.
Yeah.
Josh is a good writer. I mean, he really...
Oh, yeah.
He's the one who showed me that you got to use your best writing abilities with kids, TV. I mean, be true to the characters just like you would in a play.
Yeah.
Story. Yeah. Nothing there that's not necessary or you're ruined.
Yeah, because, I mean, Josh Selig, he created so many shows.
Yeah, like Ubi, Thurman Bird. Yeah.
Right.
Curious...
A lot of stuff, and now he's doing stuff in Japan, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I learned a lot from him, and he inspired me. But mainly, it was just the friends. I made, like, 8 new lifetime friends from that job. It was like, since kindergarten, I hadn't made so many new friends. I really had a good time there.
That's always nice. So, on PBS, you wrote for the Arthur spinoff, Postcards from Buster, which was another very fun show. What was that like?
Yes.
Well, that was weird because you're writing animated bits, right, for the Arthur characters to go with live action footage. It was sort of about American culture.
Yeah.
And so you go to different parts of the country and different sorts of neighborhoods all over the place and different communities and get real footage. The idea is that Buster's taking it with his camera. So writing for real footage, suggesting the footage, and then getting it back and saying, oh, here's what we got. I could make a joke about the giant pumpkin, because here, this is a great shot about a giant pumpkin. That was fun. And also, I love the Arthur characters. Those are such good characters.
Oh, yeah.
His sister and Buster and all those guys.
Yes. Very fun show.
Very fun show. Moving back to Disney briefly, you also got to write for the Disney Junior series Octonauts.
Yeah.
Another wonderful show. What was writing on that show like?
A lot of underwater information. I had to learn a lot about I didn't know there were so many creatures under the water. There are a lot of them. Mm. So learning about that. And that was one where there were writers from New York and Los Angeles. And maybe London, I forget the third place. But we would get, they bring us all into a giant room and to go around and pitch stories one at a time. And that was kind of scary. I'm not used to talking and trying to be creative in front of 24 people. But I also loved meeting all those writers. It was a good ensemble. And then you go off by yourself and write for it. And yeah, they did a good job with that. It was a different kind of animation, isn't it? It's more computerized, I think.
Yeah.
They're getting into that. They were getting into that at that point. So the opposite of Courage the Cowardly Dog. But yeah, fun writing for. I learned a lot about the sea.
Awesome. So one of your most well-known jobs was creating and writing for another PBS series, Peg Plus Cat. What went into kind of creating that?
Oh, that was so much fun. Jennifer Oxley, who was one of the creators of The Wonder Pets, got to know me, was interested in me as a writer since that experience. And when she was invited to pitch to PBS, they were looking for a math show. They were looking far and wide for their next math show. It would teach math to the very young and be funny. So she invited me to team up with her. And how lucky I was. It turns out there were like 36 different producing groups pitching for that show. But so it was like a tournament. You know, we made it through the first level with an 8-page pitch document. Then a few of us made it to the next level where you got to do a bigger Bible. And then after that, it was a big Bible. And, you know, where the PBS gave us a lot of input on that. And I think it was pretty much for free still. So we might have spent months, if not a year, just developing it and adding to it on spec. We're not making much money at any rate. And then, but we believed in it so badly. And Jennifer and I loved working together. Somehow she had the sense that we would work well together. I had no idea. I didn't know her that well. But it turns out we had the same sensibility. We both like things that are sort of, well, I guess I would say original. Her art is really original, and it has a lot of personality. Mm-hmm. It's unique, and I love that. And also her sense of storytelling, that it can work. Funny should be funny. You should laugh, or it's not funny. And she has a sense of sweetness, and I a sense of, I wouldn't call it nastiness, but irony, whatever. That I think it went well together. And we learned a lot from each other. And so eventually, yeah, then you got to make a pilot. We made our Chicken Problem episode. We spent a whole, like, 9 months making that one episode. And it tested well. I guess it was one of the three that they made. And we finally went on and became a show. And then we got to do, it was kind of like a fantasy. I mean, you suddenly got all this money to do, to hire. Well, and Jennifer already knew who she wanted to hire. She knew the best, who she felt were the best people in every part of the children's TV business, and she brought them together to make her dream team. And I got to invite some of my favorite writers to join us, and then the composers we got to work with. A lot of it was just bliss. The responsibility was not bliss. That's hard. Having to yeah. With PBS, you don't just come and live at people like at Nickelodeon or Disney. They'll pay for everything. They'll take care of all that. With PBS, we had to form our own company. So we set something up in Brooklyn where we live, and we're responsible then for making sure the rent got paid and that people were doing their job just right. But basically, it was kind of a dream job. And we created lots of episodes. I guess what was scary, the hardest part for me was that in making the pilot, we spent 9 months on one episode. Then when you get the show, you realize you've got to come up with four new ideas every 6 weeks, which starts to get to, so before long, you're working on coming up with four new ideas while you're looking at outlines for the last four ideas and treatments for the four ideas before that, and first drafts of this four ideas before that. So you're keeping so many episodes in mind at once, and you're as a writer, I felt responsible for them all, for making sure that the writing was working. And also, if you want to keep on that assembly line of going from the writing to the animation to the music and all that, having the characters design, you can't mess up. If you have a note, if something looks wrong, you've got to catch it in storyboard before it gets to animation, or no one will like you. If you try to say, can we move that, you know, when it's already animated, that they're not going to want to do that.
Right.
You got to make sure it's clear, that the education is clear, and that the story is clear, and that any voices are audible, and that it really works and makes sense as soon as you can. Kind of exhilarating, like an athletic event, but, you know, with not much rest.
Right. So now, are there any Peg Plus Cat episodes that stick out as some of your favorites?
Yeah, many. Well, the first one with 100 chickens in the pilot, that will always be a favorite.
Yes.
Yes,
I love that one.
With so many chickens. Mm-hmm. It just turned out 100 chickens. There's something funny about that. Yeah. And
that. I remember watching that episode, that exact episode, like the very first episode when it was like first like premiered. So
yeah.
Yay.
It was Thank a great you. One.
Yay.
There's one where Beethoven, of course. Beethoven needs to create an idea for a symphony, and Cat laughs. Ha 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 ha. He says, oh, short, 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 long. So it's about teaching patterns, short, 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 long.
Yeah.
Long. Yeah.
And we did one with Misty Copeland, the dancer, in which she played herself. And that was about how it doesn't matter how you look to be a dancer. What matters is how you make people feel.
Yeah.
That was a sort of her message, and it worked with our show. And we did there was a four-part episode where the pig is going to crush the earth with his behind. So if they don't, so Peggy Cat had to save the world based on a true story. No, that's never happened. Sandra, the actress, was the president of the United States. So we got to work with her, which was a pleasure. There were so many that were fun.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Nice. The sleepover problem. Yeah.
Right. Where the pirates.
The pirate one, yeah.
Yeah, the pirates one, yeah. That's pirates a good one.
And they get the pirates to sleep.
And the long line.
Long problem. Line problem, yes.
And there is one that's from the holiday episode, the Christmas problem.
Yeah, Christmas where they have to come to a... We wanted to, you know, that's kind of a... it's the brass ring of math shows, is if you can get them to count to 100 and it's not boring. So yeah. All the characters that we'd ever created into that episode so that Peg and Cat would count them and make it interesting somehow as they save Christmas. We also did an episode about the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha, which I knew nothing about, but it turned out that came out just when Donald Trump had been elected, and there was he was very tough on the Muslim community, and so we felt very proud that it was there and honoring them at that time. That's one of my favorite episodes for that reason.
Yeah, I might remember that too.
Mm.
And we managed to teach math with it. I think dividing things in three. So
right,
there's math everywhere. You could always find a way to do that.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, great show.
Thank you. It was fun.
Absolutely. So moving on from TV writing, you're also a playwright, and you originated the concept of the rock opera Rent, which won 4 Tony Awards, including Best Musical in 1996. How did that come about?
Okay. Well, after writing early in my New York playwriting time, after writing a bunch of plays and waiting to hear from theaters if they were going to get done or anything, I decided rather than start another play, I didn't have anyone new to beg to read it. So I thought I better try something different. And I'd always loved music theater, musicals, operas, whatever. So I had this idea. Well, I used to go to the opera a lot when I was new in town, because my apartment was so small that I couldn't daydream there. I didn't have my own room. I mean, it was two people living together, and the other guy had the bedroom. Then the other room was just where I would unfold the couch. So I had no place to be. So if I wanted to be alone, I would go get standing room at the Metropolitan Opera. And for 4 hours, for $5, maybe it was, you could just stand there. But I really did love some of the operas. And La Boheme was one about, I felt it was about me. It was about these really poor artists who'll do anything for money, but they're happy. they have these girlfriends and they have their loves and they love each other. They have great friends and they love struggling together. But it's also a very luscious opera, gorgeous soaring music. And my life at that time, or the streets of New York were not that, they were the opposite. So I got the idea to do a bohème that was about then, which is the later 80s, when the homelessness was becoming skyrocketing and AIDS was just a terrible, unavoidable crisis. You couldn't look away from it. It was so terrible. And people just, it was fashionable to be rich or to have money at that time. We used the word yuppies a lot, which I was not. So I had that idea, but it needed some kind of rough music, loud, the opposite of the opera. So I went to this theater, Playwrights Horizons, where they were interested in my work. And Ira Weitzman, the musical theater guy there, recommended me to Jonathan Larson, who was, he felt was an up and coming talented guy, along with another composer. I met with both composers and Jonathan really wanted to do this idea that I had. So we worked on it together for a year or two. And we came up with three songs that we loved. The title tune, Rent, I Should Tell You, and Santa Fe. But we didn't know what to do with it beyond that. I didn't really know how to make it all into a story that he would like. And so anyway, we didn't communicate very well at all. Unlike the collaborations I've described with Jennifer Oxley, for example, we really got each other. Jonathan, we just didn't click. And so for one thing, you know, the shows I've mentioned, all of them have a sort of a sense of humor, however serious they are. And he took this very, well, I was serious about the show, but with a sense of sort of irony about it, I guess I would say. And he didn't like that. He doesn't have that tone. He wanted characters to be able to come downstage and shout, I love you, or I'm dying, that kind of thing to the audience. And he made it work, but it just wasn't my writing style. So I said he could go ahead on his own, and he did. And it went well, actually. He did very well. It still has a lot of the lyrics that I wrote and the basic idea. And so I got credit and I got compensation because I was wise enough. With all these projects, you got to get something in writing. And when you're a freelance writer, you know that because, you know, if you don't have something in writing from this person, then after you turn it in and send them a bill, you're never going to hear, you might never hear from them. They might not exist. They might say, oh, we never made the project anyway, or they might leave town or they might forget about you. You got to have that piece of paper. So Jonathan and I made sure to have a piece of paper that said, if anything happened with it, that first of all, it said he could go ahead on his own. That was important to him. And then also said that I would get the credit and compensation if it went anywhere.
Oh, yeah, ran on Broadway for a long, long time. Again, won Best Musical in 1996. I'm sure that must have been thrilling for you, considering it opened like right as... you know, the cutoff was, because shows aren't in the Broadway world, usually around April, May ish, it's like the cutoff for the Tony Awards, which is their big annual for international viewers. It's a big international, it's Broadway's biggest night, pretty much.
Right.
And Rent, as I said, won Best Musical in 1996, ran on Broadway for a long, long time.
At the time that it was the seventh longest running show in the history of Broadway. I think other things, a lot of other things have run longer since, but at that time, and I was just shocked that it went to Broadway because I never thought of it as that kind of show. It seemed so downtown to me. Broadway has changed since Rent, but at the time, you didn't see shows about lots of people dying. Certainly no one dying of AIDS. You didn't see gay characters kissing. You couldn't imagine people wearing black, everybody wearing black with no particular fancy set. You know, why would it be on Broadway? But the songs are so powerful and it was so right for its time. I guess he wrote great songs. And so it's worked very well. It got the Tony, but it also got like the Obie Award for Downtown Theater and the Pulitzer Prize. It was like it worked on so many levels. And it created kind of a hysteria to get in, to get to see it in the beginning. You couldn't get a ticket. It's sort of hard to explain the feeling when it first opened because there are other shows that have run longer, but I don't remember Wicked being the kind of thing where people are dying to get in and people are crying. Kids would cry at Wicked, but it had a very powerful effect on people at that time. And it's always running somewhere, it turns. I get a checks from one, you know, every now and then, and I'm glad to see it's alive in so many ways.
Definitely.
Yeah, I guess you could say the same for Hamilton as well, because that was huge when it
that's true.
Got off the ground.
That's a big
one. Yeah, Rent, very big for its time.
Yeah, so you wrote the book for the Click Clack Moo musical. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, there's a group called TheaterWorks USA in New York that creates one-hour musicals for kids and tours them all around the country. And it's, of course, it's very hard to make money in the theater, but TheaterWorks has it down. They know what they're doing because they can find their shows are performed in New York, but they're also sent all over the country to schools and to towns, and they know just what the people, Barbara Pasternak, who's in charge basically, knows exactly what her market wants and can find ways to be creative about it. So I've been talking to them for a long time about doing a project because I love writing for kids and I like money. So I said, finally she sent me this book, Click Clack Moo, Cows the Type. And she thought it would be good for me, and I liked it because it was about, essentially, it's a great children's book, a picture book. Mm-hmm. But it's about learning to take power, learning to express yourself so you can stick up for yourself. A very serious thing. You know, I'm kind of revolutionary and a great thing to teach kids. You know, find a way to express yourself so that you don't get pushed around. I thought it was great. In addition to being really charming characters and lots of opportunity for story. And that was the only time I got to just write the book for a musical, which if people don't know, that's... Because when you see a musical, you notice there are songs everywhere, and you notice there's little bits of talking in between the songs. The talking in between the songs is the book, but so is the story itself that's underneath all the songs. So first you write the whole thing like a play, and then organize the story. Everybody has to agree on the story. And then the composer and lyricist, who were not me, the songwriters, say, I want a song here. So we're going to take out that chunk of dialogue here. We're going to take out that scene here. We're going to make those into songs. And it's kind of a wonderful process. It builds, and then you've got these great songs that all fit together, and everybody's excited about the songs and singing the songs, and you're thinking, I'm at the bottom of that somewhere. But it's a fun job. I like it. And I was with such talented people. John Rando, the Broadway director, was directing it. Kevin DeLagula was the lyricist. He's a hilarious guy. He wrote for us on Peckless Cat, and he acts on Broadway too. And so we had a great time. Oh, and Brad Alexander was the composer, writes charming melodies, really fun. He did pick with Cat songs too.
Very nice. So over the years, you've also written a number of your own plays. Could you kind of talk about and describe some of them?
Sure. Well, that was sort of always at the center. It was writing the play. What's the next play? And there were different theaters here and there that did them at different times. There was a theater called Ensemble Studio Theater. There is a theater on way west of the 50s that does a one-act festival every year called the Marathon, because the idea is like just keeps going and going with one-act plays. And I found that was one of my favorite situations to produce, to write plays, one of the best places to have my plays. Because I found if I could write a 20-minute play and get right to the point with something, that I was the best at that. Whereas often my full-length plays seemed a little stretched. And that, so I could squish them down to a one act that was good. So most of my plays that I had produced in New York were one act plays at that festival. I also had a full length done at Playwrights Horizon. And then one year, in 2009, I had four plays done at the same time. I wouldn't recommend it. It sounds successful, but I wrote a play about, I live in Park Slope, so it was sort of about those kind of parents, helicopter parents who seem to have control of the world. I shook them up so they have no control over the world by using sex. So it's a big farce, all kinds of crazy, dirty sexual stuff. Mm. And we've done both in Philadelphia and in San Francisco at the same time. So it was flying back and forth with both productions. They both got laughs in all the same places, which was kind of interesting. I learned a lot from that, from being able to see the same play done in different spaces, in different cities, by different people. And so much was the same. The places they laughed, the way they laughed, the places they gasped. It was a great education being able to do that. Mm. So anyway, and I'm working on a new musical right now. That's what I'm most excited about.
Ooh.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
It's nice.
Nice. Looking Looking forward to it. Yes. Except with that, of course, it'll be happening very soon. Can you share any other projects you're currently working on?
Well, I do yoga every day. It's just one musical for me. It's an obsession. It's like, first I was writing the whole script. I just decided I was going to do the whole thing by myself in the beginning. Because with Jonathan Larson, I came in with an idea, right? And then but he didn't know exactly what I was thinking. This one, I said, I'm going to write out the whole script. All the story, all the lyrics. Here it is. This is my idea. It's a show that's based on a twisted Shakespeare play, his weirdest play that hardly anybody knows, called Troilus and Cressida, about this world in which lovers just hurt each other. They destroy each other. And about a war that people try to end, but every time they try to end it, they only make it worse. The only way they think they can stop killing is by killing. So it's now. It's basically about now. So I got this idea, and I found a composer. She's a Korean composer who lives in Brooklyn, who writes jazz music. And so it's a whole different sound. And we're working together. We've written three songs, and now we're looking for producers. So it's full time, because whatever I'm doing, whether it's writing it, looking for a composer, working with the composer, looking for a producer, I devote myself totally to that. I wish I had another project to distract myself, but that's the main thing right now. And looking all over the world for people to do it. It's fun. Nice. It's a way to engage with the world. I like making plays.
Yeah. So to end this off here, the last question that I'm going to ask is a question we ask all of our guests at the end. So this podcast is called Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show. When you think of nostalgia, what do you think of? Or in your own words, how do you define the word nostalgia?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm someone who loves the old shows, old stuff. I just, when I was a kid, the Monkees, the Man from U.N.C.L.E., the early Beatle albums, you know, I'm obsessed with that stuff still. And it was good. I mean, the Batman show, I don't know if you guys have seen it, was in the late 60s, Batman was a TV show. Mm-hmm. That was two nights,
mm-hmm.
Wednesday and then Thursday. Oh, that blew my mind. It was colorful. It was exciting. It was hilarious and ridiculous and sexy. I just can't get my mind off that stuff. I'm very nostalgic. Also, old friends, I think about all the time. I remember all the details from school, what people said to me in high school. And I still apologize for things I said to them in high school. So I'm a very nostalgic guy. I like the idea of nostalgia, the old stuff. And I'm so impressed that you guys know so much old stuff that was like before you were born or from your youth.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah,
in life, if something is good, you want to go back to it, I think. You can't understand it all at once. It's not just an indulgence, nostalgia. I think there's a wisdom to it, figuring out why that was so powerful and seeing it with different eyes when you're older.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Billy, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was a blast.
It was fun. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for what you've done over the years, and keep up the great work of what you're doing now. Thank you so much for what you've done with writing things that you've done to be a part of our world, and keep up the great work of what you're doing now. And I cannot wait for sex in store.
Wow. That's very sweet of you to say. Thanks a lot.
Yes. Keep in touch, Billy. I'll let you know when this goes up.
Oh, great. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Yes. Enjoy the rest of your day, Billy.
It's okay, Billy.
Bye. It's goodbye from us as well. We absolutely enjoyed our time speaking with Billy Aronson. Links to his website and social media will be in the description down below for anyone who wants to connect with him or check out his work. But it's goodbye from Billy. It's goodbye from us as well. Keep on the lookout for more wonderful interviews coming your way. And as always, what do we say, Jake?
Keep nostalgia alive. Take care, everyone. See you next time. Take care. Bye.
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 Thank you for tuning in to another wonderful Jake's Happy Nostalgia Show interview. Be sure to follow Jake and the crew on social media and stream the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And as always, remember to keep nostalgia alive. Bye-bye.